There are two young women that you know of that walked to Bethlehem, or at least journeyed there. One is pretty obvious. Every year we pretty well give her some attention, and rightfully so. And the young woman who went to Bethlehem that everybody knows is the name Mary. But there's a second young woman who also went to Bethlehem. In fact, the other woman who went to Bethlehem is the reason Mary ended up going to Bethlehem. They're separated by a number of years. But the other young woman who journeyed to Bethlehem is Ruth. And that's the book we're on this morning. In fact, the reason we're studying the book of Ruth has to do, we've been in a series in the book of Judges entitled, How to Ruin Your Life. It was a series that we went through just character after character, because that's what they do in the book of the Judges, just constantly ruin lives, foolishness repeated over and over again, and I think some valuable, important lessons. Well, the book of Ruth fits within that context, only it's not the broad sweeping picture of the whole nation. It's a snapshot of one family. One family. The family is the family of Elimelech. How you say that fast without stuttering or slurring your words a little bit? But Elimelech. Elimelech has a wife named Naomi, and they know hard times. They know hard times. In fact, the text will tell us in this book of Ruth that a famine hits the land during the time of the judges. Now, I do not believe, and I don't think the scriptures would hold to this, that every famine is directly from the hand of God as a judgment on the land. That wouldn't be true. But sometimes it is, and I have no doubt that this time wasn't. God will take and turn things upside down and shake your cash register if you're just living crazy. I mean, God will try to save your life by shock value. Look, they're eternal things, and you're losing those for short-term things. And so I think God did that. I think a famine occurred at his hand. Well, the choice that Elimelech made with his wife Naomi is they took their sons, Mahlon and Chilion. Boy, where's a good Tom, Dick, or Harry naming this thing? But anyhow, Mahlon and Chilion, and they go around the Dead Sea to the other side, to the land of Moab, and they go there for the sake of the famine. Now, I don't know whether there's anything unfaithful in them doing that. In fact, I know Abraham left the land because of hard times and a famine, and I know other characters, and I don't know any rebuke in that. But he left, took his family. When he left, his sons married Moabite women. Mahlon married a little girl named Ruth, and Chilion married a girl named Orpah. And at that point in time, you say, okay, it's hard times, but every family has hard times, and you do what you got to do. It collapses worse. It collapses to the point that you have a woman, Naomi, who is a distraught woman, a broken woman. In fact, this book, you need to understand, starts with a very, very broken woman. Life's just too hard, just crushed. Because Elimelech, her husband, dies. And if you're already just living hand to mouth, and famines will do that, then you got to depend upon your sons because there's nothing else. And both boys die. So she loses all the males in the family. And that leaves her basically penniless, no hope, no future. This book is a really hard book to start. This book has a really sweet, sweet ending. How do you get from hard things where you start to sweet endings? I think everybody in this room would like to know that a little bit. Because I think everybody knows a little about the land of Moab. I think everybody knows a little about that journey back. And we're going to talk about it. Turn in your Bibles, if you would, the book of Ruth. Start in the first chapter. First chapter of the book of Ruth. I want to start in verse 6. Ruth chapter 1, verse 6. Then she arose with her daughter-in-laws to return from the country of Moab, for she had heard that the Lord had visited his people and given them food. So she set out from the place where she was with her two daughter-in-laws and went on the way to return to the land of Judah. But Naomi said to her two daughter-in-laws, "Go, return each of you to her mother's household. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me." Now, you just need to picture this very poignant, these three women standing alongside a road. Three penniless, I think, basically destitute women. The old woman who's crushed, the two young gals who say, we're going to go back with you, and her going, no, don't follow me. Go home. Weeping and going home. That's the word she says. Verse 9. The Lord grant that you may find rest, each of you, in the house of her husband. Then she kissed them and lifted up their voices and wept. And they said to her, no, we will return with you to your people. But Naomi said, no, turn back, my daughters. Verse 11, 12, I'm not going to read in that section, but what she says there is, look, I have nothing to offer you. Nothing. I have no sons to marry you and look after you. I have nothing. There is nothing I have to offer you. She even makes the comment, if I could have more sons who could look after you, they would, but you can't. Verse 13. No, my daughters, the middle of verse 13, for it is exceedingly bitter for me, to me, for your sake, that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me. That's her view. And I can't fuss with her on that. Not at least as it would look from her. The hand of the Lord is against me. They lifted up their voices and wept again, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. What it says in that text is Orpah kissed her goodbye, and Orpah went back, but Ruth still clung to her. This woman who says, God's hand is against me. Now, you need to get a little more of that flavor when you go just a few more verses. Go down to chapter 1, verses 20 and 21, because Naomi will go ahead and go on home, and Ruth will go with her. You'll know that part of the story. When she gets back to Bethlehem, I'm sure other women started hollering, is that you? Is that you, Naomi? Well, Naomi, I haven't seen you in 10 years. Is that you? You haven't gained a bit of weight. No, I'm joking. I'm confident in the days of the famine, that was not one of the things that women worried too much about. In fact, I think the flattering thing was, wow, you look heavier. God must be good to you, you know. But in this conversation, it goes this way. She said, then do not call me Naomi. Call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has brought calamity on me? She says, don't call me Naomi. I've changed my name. And she uses the word for bitter. I don't think that's probably a reflection of her heart as much as a reflection of her lot. My lot has been bitter. There are people in this room who can identify with that. Everybody is equal. Every human being is equal. But not everybody has an equal life. Everybody in this room will have hard times. And so what I'm going to say today is going to apply to everybody at some level because we all have hard times. But let's not kid ourselves. Not all things are equal. And there are people in this room whose life is incredibly hard. There are people in this room that there are chapters, long, long chapters, that they're just not like anybody else's chapter. I mean, you take simple things like why can't a decent job? I mean, the job he needs or the job she needs to take care of the family. We pray about it, and we lay it out before God, and we say, God, please. We've tightened the belt every way we can. We try to watch finances. We're trying to live holy and righteous. How come other people fall out of bed and it seems like a blessings run over them? I fall out of bed and I hit the floor. And I say, God, please, please. If there's a lesson you want us to learn, God, we want to learn it, please. But year after year after year, you just feel like, in fact, your home group has prayed about it and prayed about it and prayed about it, and you're sick of bringing it up in your home group because it feels like you're just, by this point in time, can I understand God is telling me no? But what do we do? There are those of you at Christmas season, it's hard. Let's not kid ourselves. You drive down streets, and I know that we all fabricate a little bit of what we see inside houses, but you drive down streets, and you see the great big picture window on that nice house, and you see the Christmas tree and the kids playing, and you know the hot chocolate and the laughter and the rolling in the floor, and that family has something, but why is my husband unfaithful? And why are my kids not growing up in that kind of house? And I've begged God for repentance. And every time it looks like he repents, he behaves like the same jerk he was before. And there's unfaithfulness again. And my kids' hearts get broken. How's that? The issue, I think, is common. There are people in this room who would say the same thing. My life feels very, very bitter. I don't want to be bitter. I have a letter that I really wanted to read this morning. I held it up. I laid it down. I picked it up. I laid it down. It's on my desk. It came on Tuesday's mail. Maybe Wednesday's mail. It's a letter from a woman whose hand she writes 2.5 pages of some of the saddest continuum of somebody's life you can imagine. And she's not fabricating a thing. I can't read it. And I'm around pain a lot. I can't read it without just tearing up. It's a hard, hard life. Now, we all have chapters of that. There's chapters. What do you do with that? The central question at hand, is God for me? Is God against me? Or maybe even worst of all, does God even care or know? Maybe I'm living out my life on Oak Street or whatever it is, and he doesn't even know or care. I live or die, it's like leaves blowing in the backyard. So what? They do that sort of thing. Naomi had come to the place that she was convinced God knew and God didn't care. Chapter 1, verse 15. Obviously, by the way, there's no way to preach. I've been frustrated every time I preach this text this morning. This is a better book than I can figure out how to get all this in there. So you pray for me and you listen well and I'll work hard and we'll see what we can get done. The end of the book obviously tells you things are not as they appear at the first. Let's watch how it begins to transform. Chapter 1, verse 15. And Naomi said, "See, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." But Ruth said, "Do not urge me to leave you or return from following you. For where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God my God. And where you die, I'll die and be buried. May Jehovah do so to me and more also, if anything but death parts me from you." This is an incredible statement of loyalty. Really, two things take place in this. One is incredible loyalty. I don't know the depth of pain that Naomi would have been feeling, but one of the things that I do know about all pain is it always causes you to see the situation as more hopeless than it really is. Now, I'm not trying to be Pollyanna and take away pain, but as painful as hers is, here's one thing she does have. She has a daughter-in-law in the middle of her, my life is just bitter. She has a daughter-in-law who's incredibly loyal. Where you go, you'll never have to worry. These hands will take care of you. I will love you and look after you. And so you have that episode taking place. I do think it's interesting, this little sideline. Evelyn Knowles, Victor Knowles' wife, has a column that she puts in Victor Knowles' newsletter. And I happened to read it this last week. Victor Knowles has a ministry here in town. But Evelyn commented that she was walking in the doctor's office or something like that. And she was holding the door open for somebody, for another woman. And Evelyn just said, as I looked at the sky, it was gorgeous. And so I couldn't help but say to the gal walking in, "Isn't this a wonderful day?" And the lady kind of looked up at the sky with me and she said, "Yeah, the day's pretty, but I'm having a lousy day or a terrible day." And now many of you know how this conversation goes. You've had it in Walmart checkout line and everywhere else. You know exactly how this conversation goes. And the gal didn't wait for an invitation. She just started telling Evelyn, "I locked my keys in my car and I was locked out and the doctor's appointment and I don't know, the dog," or, you know, just started this litany of things that are making it a horrible day. And I understand that's what she saw. As she walked through the door, her husband happened to come behind her. And he'd overheard part of the conversation. And I love the line. In fact, I think it's worth hanging on to. As the wife went on, the husband leaned forward to Evelyn, who's still at the door, and said, "Actually, She's having a good day. She just doesn't know it yet. And I think in a sense, if you want to sort of write that in the margin, Naomi, you're having a good day. You just don't know it yet. I mean, and again, I don't want to take away the pain. The pain's really there. But all pain will blind you to some realities that are also taking place. In fact, I guarantee you, if you're struggling with resentment on how bad your life is, I promise you, you're probably missing a portion of this. Don't take away the pain, but here's a portion. But the second thing I want you to notice is while Naomi says, God's hand is against me, you have this little Moabite girl who steps forward and says, your God will be my God. That's a commitment to Jehovah. I want you to notice in chapter 2, verse 12, there's a phrase that will be used by Boaz, who is a character who will show up later on. Verse 12, this is what Ruth really did. Boaz said, the Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. What took place that day on the road to Bethlehem out of Moab was a young Moabite girl said, I understand the pain and I don't deny it, and I live in the same situation, but I put myself under the wings of that God. And Ruth does. So here's the question we have. Those of you who put yourself under the wings of that God, is he trustworthy? Is he trustworthy? Our first lesson, we'll get ahead of ourselves, but the first lesson you're going to clearly see is this lesson in this text, that God redeems our lives out of pain and tragedy. That's the first obvious key lesson. In fact, we'll build around that. But God redeems our life out of pain and tragedy. And so here this old woman and this young woman walk empty-handed into Bethlehem. How's God going to redeem it? I can't imagine. What's he going to do? And so here's the story. Chapter 2, verse 1. Now Naomi had a relative of her husband's, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after him in whose sight I shall find favor. And she said to her, go, my daughter. Gleaning is the process by which really, really poor people had a really, really hard way to try to make a life. When you harvest barley or you harvest wheat, you're going to cut the stalk, and there's going to be a certain amount of straw, and then at the top of this, that stalk or straw is going to be the head. And so you cut it, and then the harvesters would gather it up. Well, they're not going to pick up every single individual stalk, because some are going to fall the wrong directions. And so there'll be individual straws with a little grain, head of grain at the top. They'll fall off to the side, and so the workmen go on. The second thing that would occur is when you cut the stalks of wheat or barley, there's a head on the top, and sometimes that head will pop off. So you cut the stalk, and you have the straw, but the head itself just fell off, this little short piece. Well, nobody would go back and hunt for the heads falling down on the grass. You'd have to paw through and look for it like you kind of needle in the haystack, but you will if you're poor enough. You will if you're poor enough. And you need to picture, here's what this woman is doing, is she's going along behind the grain that's been harvested, picking up individual stalks that have a head on them, and she's pawing through the grass, trying to find individual heads that may have fallen. Now, one of the verses, well, the verse we're at here right now, verse 3. So she set out and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers, and she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the clan of Elimelech. And on that verse, you begin to recognize that there's a providence of God, and that what God is doing behind the scenes, what you'd simply call the hidden work of God, begins to take place. And there's this guy, Boaz. Boaz is a relative of some level of Elimelech, late husband. Now, what Ruth does is she gleans and she works hard and she asks the people, the foreman of the field, can I glean here? And the foreman said, yes. And when Boaz comes to check on his field, he said, who's this gal? And that's the Moabite girl. And she's asked permission and she's worked hard. Man, she's worked all day hadn't taken a break. This gal's impressive. And Boaz invites her in. They have a meal with the whole group, invites her to that meal. She goes home. He treats her kindly. When she goes home, she tells Naomi, I was treated well by Boaz. Boaz was kind. And Naomi says a little phrase, and there's not, again, time to do it well this morning in this, but says, you know, he's a redeemer. What? He's a redeemer. In Jewish law, if you were poor and you lost a piece of property, it was the job of a redeemer to buy that piece of property back and present it to you. So if the cousin lost the business, Uncle Frank would come and buy it back, and Uncle Frank could give it back to you. The redeemer did that. The second thing a redeemer would also do, and kind of blurring some things together, but the second thing a redeemer was responsible was taking care of a widow by marriage. You know he's a redeemer. And suddenly the plot thickens. So what she says to her is, Naomi says to Ruth, here's what I want you to do. At night, the men guard the threshing floor so that the thieves don't come and steal the grain. I want you to go and I want you to see where Boaz lays down. And when he goes to sleep, I want you to go in and lay at his feet at the threshing floor. I've gone through commentaries. I read this over and over again. You know, I don't think this is nearly as sexual as our culture tries to read into it. We have every innuendo that we can put sexual that we can possibly do in our culture. I mean, there's a 36 words that we all sort of go, you can't use that word. It has an innuendo with it. We have all kinds of hand signals and signs, everything. I'm confident they had sexual innuendos as well, but this, I don't think this is one of them. Because she says to him, go and lay at his feet. And ultimately what she ends up doing is say, when he asks you who you are and what's taking place, and she coaches her on what to say. Sure enough, she lays down at the feet of Boaz. Boaz was an honorable man. She's an honorable woman. It says so in the text. He wakes up and says, what is this laying at my feet? What's this? And basically what she uses is a Hebrew phrase, the equivalent of, will you marry me? I mean, that's the kind of the equivalent. I mean, it's would you take a corner of your blanket and cover me, which is their a basic idiom that has to do with would you marry me? Might be forward. Nobody calls it subtle. But would you be the redeemer? They have a conversation, and Boaz said, yes, I will. Oh, but we have a problem. There's another man who's a closer redeemer, and he has the right. So the next morning, Boaz goes to the city gate, and there at the city gate, the other man who's a closer redeemer, maybe a first cousin instead of a second cousin, I don't know. But as he goes through, he stops and says, say, in front of witnesses, I want to have a conversation with you. That land that belongs to Naomi, that land that has to be redeemed back, that she can't afford and so forth, will you redeem it? Well, the guy's going, well, sure, she has no family, no boys, I inherit it, it's a good deal, sure, I'll add it to the family. And he says, yes, I'll redeem it. Boaz's heart had to sink. So Boaz throws the second part in. Well, you know she has the Moabite widow, that if you take the land, you also have to get the widow, and you need to. And so the posterity of the land will go back to. And the guy says, oh, no, that's more complications than I want. No, thank you. I step out. And Boaz steps in. And Boaz is the redeemer. Now we pick up chapter 4, verse 13. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. And he went into her, and the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. Then the women said to Naomi, blessed be the Lord who has not left you this day without a redeemer, and may his name be renowned in Israel. He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age, for your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is more to you than 7 sons, has given birth to him. Then Naomi took the child and laid him on her lap and became his nurse. And the woman of the neighborhood gave him a name, saying, a son has been born to Naomi. And they named him Obed. And he was the father of Jesse, the father of David. And suddenly, it explodes. This text is about the hidden work of God. You get one family, and you get to look at this family where God runs rewind and fast forward, and you get to watch the whole family. Most of the time, we don't get that. But God says, I want you to know what my pattern is. I redeem pain and tragedy. Let me show you in a family how I redeem it. Let me show you what I do. Let me show you the sovereignty of God, the providence of God. There's a central truth that God redeems our life out of pain and tragedy. You read the book of Job and watch Job's life, watch Joseph's life, watch Daniel's life, watch David's life, watch Paul's life, watch Peter's life, watch the cross and the very tomb itself. If you want to know what God does in redemption of pain and tragedy, watch the life of Ruth and Naomi, the standard normal operating procedure of God is to redeem pain and tragedy and those who have put themselves under his wing. And so you have this broken pinata, this crushed broken pinata, and you go, what good thing can come? And the answer is the grace of God pours out of that in incredible ways. This morning, I have to ask the question, do you believe that? And I know that if I ask, do you believe that? The answer is going to have a little more definition to it. Do you believe that God will partner with you? You who put your trust in him, you who will live faithful, do you believe that God will partner with you? And do you believe that in the light of the long picture, in light of eternity, in light of the long term, that God will partner with you and always, always, always redeem pain and tragedy? Or do you believe that partnering with God needs to occur in the short term? I'll partner in the short term, in the present, in the now. And God, if you'll partner with me in the short term, I'll partner with you. Here's the basic truth of Scripture. If you decide to partner with God on the short term, you might as well walk away now. He hadn't operated that way in the past. He didn't operate that way now. He will not operate that way. You operate on the short term, you might as well call yourself bitter, and you might as well walk away from the Christian life at the moment. If you say, God, my life is incredibly hard, but I will trust you, and in 3 months, I trust that you'll turn this around and redeem this and turn it into wonderful things, and we'll all be praising you and our family, you probably need to close up shop now and quit. The house of John the Baptist would have been crushed. The house of James would have been crushed. The house of family of Stephen would, I mean, read through half the guys in the book of Hebrews. If I believe that I partner with God on the short term, you're going to find yourself angry and disappointed and bitter and resentful, and you'll hate every good story you hear at church. Every story where someone's pain's been redeemed, you'll resent that very story. There are individuals who hate it when we have testimonies on a Sunday morning because it just reminds me I don't have that one. Mine's still here. On the other hand, the question of whether I partner with God in the long term, God, that I will trust you not over the 3 months or the 3 years or maybe even the 30 years, but God, I will trust you in the light of eternity that you'll redeem. That changes most everything, and that is the only one that's biblical. Let me remind you, trusting God with the parts is really hard. David, have you read what David writes in the Psalms? David writes things in the Psalms I wouldn't have the nerve to say, at least up here. I say them probably in my own prayers, perhaps, but up here I wouldn't have the nerve to say. I mean, David goes, God, this makes no sense. This is horrible. And yet, while David knew the parts didn't make sense, here's one thing that's always true about David. He always trusts God in the whole. The part didn't make sense, but I trust you with the whole. Job, same thing. The part didn't make sense. In fact, Job cries out, this makes no sense. I don't understand. How could this be for the glory of God? How could anything be good at this? How could you advance the kingdom? How could anything good happen? The part makes no sense, but he trusted God with the whole. In fact, Job's line, though he slay me, yet will I serve him. In the whole I do. A great deal of life, you need to know that the part will never, never, ever, ever make sense. And you've got to decide whether you'll serve God in light of the long term or the short term. It's a funny little visual analogy, but maybe it'll work for you. A ship. Every single part of a ship ultimately makes no sense for how that ship will work. Take a bolt, and you drop it in water, and every bolt that'll go in that ship, every single bolt, if you put it in water, it doesn't float. It sinks. Every rivet. Say, I'm trying to decide whether to trust this ship or not. I'm going to see if the rivets float. Well, they won't. They will sink. So you take the iron plates, the huge iron plates, and you say, well, maybe they'll float. And they won't float. You can't get a single part of a ship to float. And yet somehow in the hole, you can put 50 planes on it and 5,000 men. And it floats. If I can borrow that, I think a great deal of our life we'll have to recognize is I live in the parts, and the parts don't make sense. Keith Martin was sitting over here this morning. Keith Martin, I don't know a more godly, good man than Keith Martin. They don't make better men than Keith Martin. He loves the Lord. He's a good man. He knows more about loss than anybody in this room. It's not a job he signed up for. He signed up just to love the king. He's lost his wife to leukemia. He's got two children with cystic fibrosis. He's got a son that he recently lost, cerebral palsy. Had looked after that little boy for a long, long time. Last night, Keith's dad died. I just started through that sequence of things, and I haven't put everything in. That's just a few of them. I'm standing out here in the hallway afterwards, and Keith Martin is going, he's an engineer. And Keith Martin said, I had to come to the place that I would say, God, it's okay if the parts don't make sense. They don't have to make sense for me to love you and serve you. I trust your character, and I trust the whole. I don't understand the parts. I think that's every man's prayer eventually. At some point in time, you have to come to the place that you say, God, you don't owe me one explanation. Like David, I'll cry out and I'll weep and you'll hear me in the middle of the night, but God, you don't owe me one explanation until the day I see you in glory. And Lord, then I think you'll tell me the whole. One of the neat things that they tell us about Alexander the Great was Alexander the Great, he did his own battle strategies and everything else. He was the director. And he had generals with their armies, and he would direct them before a great big battle and give them all their assignments, and they would all go out and do it. But the history records that one of the favorite things the generals wanted to do was the celebration afterwards. After every big victory, he would gather his generals together, and he would have the food and the wine and the celebration, and he would walk around person by person explaining, here's how your part fit the whole. Here's how your part fit this. And he began to give, it was called the mysterion. It's the Greek word used in the New Testament for the mystery of the gospel and the mystery of God. One of the realities that I think is going to come is this concept that I shall meet the king someday, and we're sitting around, and I believe he will go, this is the part, and the part, and the part. You realize this story is about how did Jesus come to be from a family of faith? How did it be that King David, the promise made through Abraham, how did it come? And the answer is the faithfulness of a Moabite woman alongside the road and the faithfulness of a guy named Boaz at a threshing floor. You have no idea what the King of Kings is going to explain. Here's how your part. It's what it was. The reality that God redeems painful things. I think that God not only redeems painful things, but God redeems the randomness of life. This looks like just an obscure family, an obscure place. But when I read the book of Matthew, I find, lo and behold, there are their names. I read the end of this book and I find it's not random. Most of us feel like our life's not very significant. Most of us feel like I'm living a pretty random life that nobody would notice if I lived or died. It doesn't make much impact. And God's constantly crying out, no, Let me show you the chain. Let me show you the connections. In preparing this sermon, I thought through my wife's life. Just choosing Julie arbitrarily. My wife came from a dry, spiritually part of the world. My wife came from a background that on paper... How did my wife become what she is? And the answer is this pretty amazing woman who loves the Lord, who has deep impact lots of places. Funny thing is, Genevieve. Genevieve was a woman married to one of the hardest men you could ever imagine being married to. In fact, I don't think Genevieve was married to a kind man at all. Genevieve was the piano teacher for Julie. And when Julie and I first got married, we kept getting cards from this old woman named Genevieve. And I would read the cards, and I couldn't believe how deep the spiritual insight, and I couldn't believe how much the personal encouragement to this little girl from Oklahoma. Genevieve will never know her significance on this side of heaven. She'll never know. It was a family from Kentucky that moved up, and they interspersed. They were about 8 years there, and that family from Kentucky, backwoods, moved back to Kentucky. That family, the impact the Graves had on Julie. And you watch, and you say, look, don't consider your life insignificant. Don't consider your life random. This is the potter, and this is the clay. That's what we're doing. Don't take lightly what you do, and don't do what you do half-heartedly. Because in that day when he reveals, I redeemed your pain, I used it. Not everything does God cause. I know that. Sin causes a great... And yet those who cast their life on him and those who will tuck themselves under the wing, two promises. I'll redeem your pain and your life will have never been random. Jesus Christ came through this family. Is Jesus Christ coming through yours the same way? I think the invitation hymn is simply this. In my circumstance and in my life, do I have a condition that God, unless you show me how my life's being redeemed now, God, unless you show me, won't serve you. You need to know that kind of thing probably is going to leave you very frustrated. For the king has not chosen to do that. Not till later. You have to decide whether you're going to walk by faith or by sight. This invitation hymn is a pretty good place to say, God, I serve you for the long haul. God, would you do in my family what you did with this little girl from Moab? I give you me. Would you stand?